clean contact.
I'd hit it again because that shot was a defining moment. And when a defining moment comes along, you define the moment, or the moment defines you.
Oh my goodness.
Hello and welcome to the Golf Practice Podcast. My name is Andy Hayes, and with me is the godfather of golf, Peter Donahue.
Andy, it's nice to be back at the Cube.
I always have to give you, you know, the intro of all intros. Get us going. The people, I mean, the most feedback I get from this podcast, like whenever Pete is on, I can't stop listening. So I'm not making that up.
Well, that's a head turner.
Yeah. All right. Well, Chris, Alex,
Jansen.
And Jansen, a majority of our staff went to the Illinois Junior PGA Summit, where you were a presenter.
I was a presenter. I was honored to be a presenter. It was a full day, and it actually ran the gamut of talking about programs for three, four, and five-year-olds, and then, 8 through 13-year-olds, and all the way up towards the end of the day with Pat Goss being there and talking about what college D1 college golf was all about. And it was really, and then also it ended the day with the Canadian program, the national program up there. And so these were just wonderful presenters, and to be among them was really an honor. And it's my favorite part about being in the PGA. I've always loved playing in golf tournaments and competing and stuff like that, but far and away the educational workshops and conventions and things that are presented have always been my favorite.
That's awesome. Were you given, did you have a topic?
Well, my topic was really about the club, or, you know, in the sense of the kind of things that we have found useful in our junior training. A lot of it has to do with inventing ways of training people, which includes, you know, how you set up the activity, how you set up the station to be to provide feedback, and how we built tools of different kinds in order to make the club and the development of your golf athleticism more enjoyable, more straightforward. And so that's, I guess, what it was about.
One of the, I don't know if you'd call this criticism, but some of the pushback that I think we get whenever we have junior programs is parents come in and they poke their head in the door and they see kids not swinging golf clubs. So they're like, why isn't my kid hitting a golf club? And I think part of that is what you're saying, that if you just give a kid a 7-iron and ask him to try to hit it, or a pitching wedge to try to hit it, they don't quite know what to do. So you've come up with other things.
Yes. Yes, I mean, you've heard me say it before. I think that the golf club is the most sophisticated and the least obvious of all the sports tools. I mean, even a lacrosse stick, you kind of get the idea that you're going to catch the ball in your basket, and then throwing the ball is actually a counterintuitive exercise. And I think swinging a golf club and what a golf club presents to most human minds is very misleading. I think that and very difficult for them to comprehend, much more difficult than a stick bat or a paddle or a racket or even a hockey stick. And as you know, we have plenty of those things around here in order that we can help to convey ideas and have them have the student experience them. I mean, activity-based learning is one of our credos, is one of our pillars. Rather than talk to kids or people about what we're doing, we want to give them some real experience that will help them to teach themselves what they need to know.
Yep. Yesterday when I asked you how the morning went, one of the main thing you said, you're like, I learned a lot.
Yes, I did. You know, I think, as you and I talked about at some point way back when we were talking about Tim Galway and the inner game, there is, in order to have a really positive or flow experience, there needs to be a performance side of it, an enjoyment side of it, and a learning side of it. And I would say that in the learning side of it, I learned a lot about preparation. I learned again about preparation, and I learned a lot from the other presenters, and in the process of as I was reviewing on my way home and after the presentation, I was very actually uncomfortable during the presentation for any, certain reasons. One reason being a sense of really putting on a kind of a high wire act. I could have gone in there with a PowerPoint presentation and had the whole thing be a lot simpler and been a lot, had my attention more freed up on the things that I wanted to talk about. Instead, the way I ended up with things was I had an easel board that had 20 panels on it of talking points, and then I also had a file filled with video, photographs and videos taken from our classes, and so I spent way too much time, on one and then the other, and so in any case, it, from the inside, it was not a great performance. But I felt that that as I was leaving, that the enjoyment side of it, I enjoyed, the other presenters very much, and really, was very impressed with Pat Goss. I mean, Pat is a guy who has a great, generous energy, and he knew a lot of people in the room, and he demonstrated by how he did things. He'd connect with specific people in the audience, and the room actually came together. A room full of golf professionals is sometimes a room full with, so many individual people. There's sometimes not a feeling of comradeship and camaraderie. There's more of a feeling of competitiveness and I'm right and you're wrong. And Pat just is terrific at connecting the room. And so I really learned a lot from him, and his presentation was so well organized, and he was so well understanding of his time management and things like that, that it was, I learned a lot from that.
What do you think it is about golf that makes, professionals so competitive? I've been seeing this a little bit as I have been around the block.
I don't know if it's if first of all, it's an individual game, and we're looking at scoreboards that have first, second, and third. I mean, that's part of our performance all the time. We've got the 50 and 100 greatest teachers, and we're rating golf courses. It's like rating if you're going to the Louvre and saying, what's your number one? Yeah. It's like, it's kind of silly. But it serves a function. It's a marketing function.
Sure.
I mean, you're in the top 50 or the top 100. I mean, you're going to perhaps get celebrity money for your instruction and your time. And so, I see the validity of it. That's just what we do. And the tradition of this has always been, very competitive, perhaps because in the evolution of educational systems, which we can say in this case, golf professionals, golf teachers, was they had their own swings and their own experiences. So they would have different things that they noticed and different things that they would talk about and different priorities. And there was never a sense in my growing up, which was through that period of time where learning was at that second level, an evolved learning system or sport. The first level being nobody knows what to do. It's like snowboarding and half pipe and stuff. The athletes are inventing the sport as they go. So how do you coach, you know, stuff like that? Then what the second level is that everybody imitates the best performers. We look at them, we analyze them, and we try to be like them. And then the third level is the level where science gets in and actually starts testing things and exploding old myths and, you know, creating new truths and new places to go. So when I was growing up as a baby boomer, We were looking at Ben Hogan, or we were maybe looking at Byron Nelson or Jack Nicklaus or Arnold Palmer. We were looking at different things. The athletes themselves were saying different things about what they thought were important, and so we started splitting into camps, and we all had our own opinion. And you know, and my model is the model that produces more success than your model, and I don't know, it seems to just be in us that we just want to compete.
But it doesn't seem like, at least now, I wouldn't classify you as someone who really cares about competing or having your ideas, I don't know, affirmed by others. Not that makes it sound really bad, but do you know what I'm saying? Like, why have you gravitated more towards junior golf and working with other teachers?
Well, because I've always been impressed by the power of collaboration. And I've had, you know, when you sit with people who are like-minded in the sense that they have an interest or a goal of understanding that's similar to you, making us like-minded, we can offer diverging opinions, and yet we respect, if we operate with respect for one another, that is such a fruitful relationship, because it's very hard. Ray Tash, my mentor in this business, told me a long time ago, he says, very difficult for a human mind to question itself. It's always beneficial, you know, therefore, to have a coach or to have a partner, even if it's a competitive partner, you know, that's challenging your ideas and causing you to think and re-question them and to restructure them. You know, the ideas become crystallized in argument as you defend your ideas or give them up and try a different perspective. You know, I think that's where growth takes place. And so So while I've always enjoyed spending time with my own thoughts, I similarly really enjoy spending time with my mates, my comrades. You know that I've been shown so many times that other people have a lot to contribute and to help in my own enjoyment of life and evolution.
Yeah, so it's if you're missing something if you do it by yourself.
Yeah, you're missing. I mean, I think that there's a creative process that you can go through, whether you're going to write an article or write a letter, or write an essay, write a book, make a movie, design a lesson plan. I think there's always a thrill of the creative process and then the a certain pride of authorship in it, but it's not the energy that comes about when you're interacting with another individual and you're creating a moment or whether that's just a moment of in a lesson, or a moment talking with your peers about a lesson, or you know what you did and what you might do the next time. That's a very high level of enjoyment.
Okay, let's talk about the club a little bit more. What, I guess, what do you think about it? What have you, like, what's your growth or learning process about the golf club? Or, you know, Ben, imagine, like, going through this, preparing for your presentation, brought up some thoughts. And,
oh, gosh, yes. So. Yeah, the golf club was a mystery to me, you know, right from the first time I ever, you know, really seriously considered it. And my growing up, my first sport was baseball. And then I took up playing a little, you know, football, flag football and touch football, and then midget football with pads and helmets. And then golf came along somewhere about the time I was in fourth and fifth grade. And I remember sitting in the basement looking at these old clubs that my father had put in a corner down there that had they were among, I think, the first metal shafts. And then those, what they did with those was they painted them to look like wood. So that's what I remember. But I'm pretty sure that they were Spalding clubs. And so I remember looking at the 3-iron and being absolutely baffled by how that thing must work. And I, in my puzzling out, I eventually came up with I had the club resting on its heel on the floor, and I let the head flop over so that the thing was practically flat on the ground. And I thought, oh, maybe that's how it works, that it slides in like a spatula under the ball, and then it rolls and flips up and flings it off. Like, and that was
very imaginative.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when I got out to, I hadn't realized how much as a kid I was, you know, trying to sweep up the ball, scoop up the ball off the ground. And because of the back in the day in the 60s and the turf wasn't cut as close as it is today when we started cutting fairways with triplex mowers, we were still cutting fairways with gang mowers, and the ball would, you know, sit up in a nice little bit of teed upness. And I didn't actually realize that what my swing was producing or what was going on with it until I got out to California when I was in college and started having all kinds of problems hitting a clean shot, because the fairways in Palo Alto were in the fall were browned out and tight, and I hit just a little bit behind every iron, and this nest of brown grass would be pulled out of the ground, and the ball would, with the 3-iron would go about 80 yards. And I was totally baffled. Here I was, you know, I'd played golf, and now I was 17, you know, 18 years old, so I've been playing golf for 8 years, and I was still scooping the ball up off the ground, and trying to change that. You know, was a difficult process. It didn't just, you know, you don't just one day say, hey, I'm going to hit down on the ball, when you've established a mental imagery in your mind and a movement pattern that leans back a little bit and your wrists kind of cup and scoop up a little bit as you're getting to the ball. That takes a little bit of time to change.
So do you think it start, like the way you swung the club started because you had the picture of, like, I need to kind of lift up to get this ball in the air?
Sure.
That then created, like, a habit that you couldn't really get over even if you wanted to.
No, it wasn't. It was not. That's when I came squarely to the realization that this is not an intellectual exercise in the sense of that most people seem to. That I've met on the lesson tee over the years. They seem to think that the essence of the learning is just give me the information that I need, that rather than being, well, that's the first step.
So like, even though you knew that you scooped up on it and you knew you should hit down on it, and you probably could even rehearse that feeling a little bit, it was still really difficult.
Yes, because the patterns were not just in your short-term memory anymore. Sure. They were in your neurological system, as people like to say. They were in your spinal cord. Mm-hmm. You know, so they were at a level where you can't get to those kind of habits except through persistent work over time, most of the time.
Yeah. Is that how you got over it?
Oh yeah, it took me years. I mean, I had developed habits. I had developed another habit, and that was also one that we see very often on the lesson tee, and that is that I would take the club face away and try to keep it looking at the ball as long as I could, which actually required me to move my wrist. Not in an up and down pattern, but in a side to side pattern, where we call knuckles towards the target being cupped and knuckles away from the target as being bowed and shut. So I was shut, and you see that position come about very often because people honestly believe even though they might not be able to articulate it for you, they honestly believe that the club face must be at square or at right angles to the path that it's swinging on. And so I had a number of I had a number of moves because I could hook the dog out of the ball, you know, with that action. And my solution for it was similar to another player who had the same problem, and that was Arnold Palmer. You know, Arnold got to a period where he was shutting it very much, and his solution for it was to push his path out to the right, was to try to push his pull, as we used to say. And, of course, this created just, in many cases, either a dead push or a quick hook. Because, you know,
the path is so far out there.
Yeah, the path gets way out there. And so I didn't know any of those things. I was just, you know, coming along, trying to not slice the ball. And then following instruction that I got. It just so happened that my teacher was influenced by Jim Flick's new revolutionary program that he came out with back in those days, which was called Square to Square, and it was a system and a belief that encouraged that very kind of takeaway and that very kind of swing.
Encouraged a close takeaway?
Yeah, it almost killed Flick's career. I mean, he came out with it, and like a lot of innovative people, he was heralded as a genius. And then as one after the other of his students crashed and burned, his name became anathema, as we would say. Oh. It was like a curse word. And he did a great job of resurrecting his career late and, creating this persona as the previous godfather of golf. That was Jim's mantle. That's why every time you say that to me, I have to laugh.
About Jim Flick. Yeah. All right. Well, your name is much more lasting than his. Especially, I think you see it especially with kids, that they all have the way that they think the ball should be hit. And that it's almost like that idea is what causes so many of the problems that you see in their swing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, whether it's scooping or hitting down or kind of what the club is doing. But it's really hard, especially in like a camp or a group class or a group lesson, you can't sit down for 20 minutes and try to diagnose what, you know, a five-year-old thinks about the club.
Yeah, what you can do is you can give them tools and clubs that guide them. You know, and I think that's the way, you know, we have been working. You know, even at 5 years old, you want to give them clubs and tasks to do that are, you know, that are appropriate. And I think that's, and by appropriate, I mean, you know, you give them flat blades and you give them wood clubs and you let them, you know, hit off a teed up lies, whether that's tall in the grass or actually up on a tee, and then you don't, tennis balls, and we've, yes, exactly right, give them a ball that's easy to move so that they can get some fun and feedback. I mean, because that's what they want. They want to hit the ball and see it move.
Yeah, because if you have them try to hit a 7-iron, they're not going to try it 3 times and quit.
Well, that's what I feel. Yes, I think you're absolutely right. And that's just not from my memory of being a child in that same position, but it's, you know, from reaffirmation every time I enter a junior class. I mean, it's almost universal, and perhaps it's because it just makes the most sense. When you say up, your body is going to interpret up. And if that ball up, you know, that motion is going to all tend to be a lifting motion. The notion that something could wedge to the underside of a ball is not self-evident. There's nothing in our experience that shows us that that physics, and even kicking comes close to it. But I remember when I was a kid, we played a game, maybe you did too, it was a playground game, and we called it soccer. It was soccer baseball. Mm-hmm. The pitcher would roll the ball, the batter would kick the ball, everybody else was in the field, and there was a set of rules about, you know, how you were out.
We call that kickball now.
Kickball. Well, everybody wanted a bouncy ball. So, because they wanted to be able to swing up when they kicked.
Oh, they liked when it bounced.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Because the ball is now up in the air, and now I can get under it and drive it up. Mm-hmm. Whereas the rolling ball required, you know, that you know something about how to wedge underneath the ball with your foot, which is, in truth, that's the way, you know, if you look in slow motion at soccer players, that's what's happening. They're kicking to the bottom of the ball.
This doesn't really have anything to do with wedging, but when we were in school, we'd make them re-pitch if they bounced the ball in. Is that interesting?
Well, I think
maybe we more developed.
Well, I think what we did was we would do the same thing. I mean, if you didn't like the pitch, you could pick it up and throw it back and say, no, bounce it or roll it or do whatever until you got what you liked. I mean, I'm sure we adjudicated some sort of time limit or whatever. Like, hey, kick it or get out.
That's just interesting. And that you know, playground rules or preferences changed. You know, by 1998, they wanted a ball to roll,
ball
not
to
bounce.
So. Well, there you go.
So what do you think... What's been the most effective way to teach people what the club is? I mean, you've said giving them different clubs and different tools. Can you maybe describe some of those and what they do? Or?
Yeah, I would say that golf is like other sports, and then it's different from those sports. You know, that's what makes it golf. So the golf swing, to me, is benefits a lot from you can go at it from – any of a number of directions. It could be, you know, a hockey shot where you're just moving the ball with what you're able to do with a hockey stick, and those so that's one. And then there's a baseball or stick ball. And the stick ball swing is a somewhat of a symmetrical swing where the wrists cock upward under the thumbs. That's called something else in medical or, you know, specific physical education terms.
Radial deviation.
Radial deviation, yes. Yeah, good, thank you. And then there's then there's the rotation of the forearm, supination and pronation, and then there's the flexion and extension, which are the slapping motions. And so so you have those things. So you get, in baseball, you use a radial deviation to cock the bat into an L shape with your forearms, and then you use the rotation or supination and pronation as you swing through the ball, so that you can get a follow through that runs out with a bending of the elbows and a rehinging of the wrists, so that the power of the swing runs out in an easy kind of parachute like fashion. It's not exactly as we watch baseball. It's not symmetrical in the sense that you don't hit the ball at the moment your arms are, both extended. Right. You're hitting the ball at a moment before that complete extension, and that complete the extension brings about a rotation of the forearms, to a place where they're straight up and down again in front of the chest. And then they turn over from there and move over to the opposite shoulder. I wonder how understandable any of that was. But I think it's a very, but in any case, that's a very, that's a powerful whipping, striking motion. And it's very useful to know. Now, the fact that it's baseball on the ground requires you to bend over.
Yep.
And to, consider, and to consider that part of it. But that's the way I started it. It was baseball on the ground. So at any rate, those are to me, the two ways. I think tennis is tremendously helpful because the face, because you can move from the bat swing, and you can bat swing a tennis racket, and understand what the face control is. And so I think it's a tremendous, and it's so obvious because you're not bent over. You're standing up with the atlas of your head, the way it's used to relating to the world, straight up and down. So you can really learn the fundamental arm and wrist action and turn action with your body with a racket. And in a really effective way. And then you can go to a hockey stick, and then with your split-hand hockey grip, which tends to put the club on a slanted plane in the backswing, you can slide your hands together at the top of the swing and swing down from there and feel what it's like to have a golf swing.
I think we covered it. That's it. it just makes it sound so complicated, and it probably is, but man, once you get, or you see a kid hit, or once you hit a good shot yourself, I don't know, there's nothing like it.
Nothing like it. And it's just fun. It's fun to make the ball move. And you see, when you see coordinated action, with a stick, and it may not be completely coordinated. Like, you may get somebody that, knows how to draw it back and then swing it down to a impact position or a whapping position. They may be kind of a mess, as far as, what happens after that. But when you start to see that, they can, that they can get it from the pause at the drawback to impact, mm-hmm. and do it in a way where their arms and their body are coordinated, in a powerful striking motion, there you can see they're having fun because they're able to move the ball, and when they can move the ball, now the enjoyment of the game starts to blossom.
Yeah, I'm thinking for more advanced players, even myself or you, of how this idea that what you the idea of how the ball should be hit impacts the way you swing. Like, for me, I don't, I've seen you kind of rehearsing this kind of release into the ball or slap. How would you describe it? Of just, I don't know.
Flail.
A flail? That makes it sound not very, why a flail?
Well, because it's a flail is a free swinging end.
Got it. Okay. And so, like, more you're swinging the club head into the ball.
Yeah, you're swinging. I would say that a flail, you know, as you look at it as a farm, you know, an ancient farm implement, was a long staff that had a shorter staff lashed or connected to it with a leather or a leather strap or a leather, and so the end of it was free swinging. So you would move in a circular fashion, and the bottom lever would sweep along the ground and fell the wheat. So flail to me is like the end of it is a free swinging deal from your wrist down. It's not a manipulated thing.
It's not
from
like
the
me.
Stand.
Because I don't think of a flail at all. Like when I swing, I think of it's almost like a spring or a coil that are like trying to get up, you know, all the way up to the top, and it's like almost a toy or something that's going to click once it gets to the top, and then you like press a button, and as long as the club face is in a good spot and you're balanced, it's just like an uncoil, and that's through the ball. I don't even, for how important the golf club is, I strangely like, don't really think about it that much. Where I know, like, you, Chris, think a lot more about that in your teaching and in the way you know, I see you guys practicing.
Yeah, and yes, that's right. I think that, I think that we used to, you know, differentiate those kinds of swings, you know, or different kinds of swings. One that we would call, you know, a thrust would be where there's positive muscle action, you know, going all the way from the top of the backswing to the end of the swing, positive meaning it's like you're doing. It's connected through width, and then the body action, you know, pours through in a rotation and a upward movement through the ball, and probably the same thing happens. My swing would be described as more of swinging the club, where you're actually intentionally, somewhat intentionally decelerating your hands in order to accelerate the club head. There's more of the shaft in the club head, not just the club head. And so there's more of a feeling of that. And I would say that it suits me more as I'm getting older because I need more out of the shaft. I don't have the strength and the flexibility to pour it on from, you know, to the finish anymore. I've got to have the energy of the swing spent more so at the bottom so that I don't get wrenched into my finish because I don't have the flexibility through my hips and my thoracic spine anymore.
Interesting. Yeah, it's interesting how different, you know, going back to, you know, I guess where we started with some instructors having their models or their ways of swinging, that it wasn't until I like switched and tried to change my swing that I feel like I actually got a lot better at golf. Whereas before I was bent over too much. Takeaway was inside with kind of open club face, and then I would come in steep and kind of stand up on my toes through the ball. I mean, you probably saw me when I first started here, swings like that. And then it wasn't until I started thinking mostly about the body and less about the club that I, you know, a lot more distance, a lot more consistency, you know, you name it. And so I'm just thinking about how if for certain people, if they're put in to just some instructor's model, that might not necessarily be the right fit for them.
You said it. Yeah. That's where instruction is going. And that is in better diagnostics and screening of individual athletes to see, you know, what they'd be predisposed to and what they'd be most most powerful or strongest in, you know, even just starting with in which plane, you know, if you were holding the club out in front of you, are you strongest? You know, if I were to ask you to hold kind of a flexible shaft and pole, and I and you were holding it out in front of me, and I tried to push the shaft up towards your forehead, which would test your deviation strength. You're under the thumb cocking, you're chopping cocking. Or then I went to the other, to the flexion extension or the slapping plane, and I pulled that shaft back, and then I went to the diagonal plane and I pulled that shaft back. In which of those planes would you be strongest? Well, that would give us a clue as to which one we ought to choose for you.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. And it's getting more interesting, which is, you know, which is why I'm very glad for you and for, you know, all the young guys that are here at the golf practice and around the world teaching golf, is that we're getting better. And it's a very encouraging thing.
Interesting. Yeah. Going through George Genkis's online program, and in one of the recent videos, he was talking about something about just like how to not get burnt out on golf. And he was talking about kids who are going to college and playing D1. And he said like a lot of students, or he's seen lots of students, their swing is their downswing, the club face is very open, and they like flip their hands through the ball and hit a big hook. But they're good enough to go to a Division I school. Then he say they get to their school and their coach sees, well, you know, you can't come through with a club face that open on the way down. So you have to try to, you know, they make some changes in how to do that to give you a more like what they call passive club face. And he says, well, then the kid starts hitting it both. Now he's missing left and right. And now it's not, you know, it's not fun. He can't control the ball anymore. And, you know, he's seen lots of people get burnt out and quit that way. I've never heard, you know, him, Genkis, being someone who you think would have is like a very distinct way that his students swing, to kind of be saying like, hey, even if you're hitting the ball good and you know where it's going to curve, there's kind of a lot of different ways that are okay.
Well, you know, I think that there's a difference between, distinction to be made between intelligence and intellect. And intelligence, you know, is takes more into consideration, takes in the well-being of the individual. And Chilton Pierce, who's a child developmental psychologist, once said, "It's intelligence is something that would always act to preserve the species and the health of the planet." As a for instance, intellect is that function and strength in us that just loves to take on challenges, and sometimes it's guided by a desire to be right or to be special or to be profitable or powerful. And so so intelligence is more, I would say, George on a spectrum is closer to real intelligence than someone who would, you know, just see something that their eye and their preference said, I don't like this. I don't think this is the right way to swing. I think they need to change and they need to conform to, you know, this that I believe. And that's one of the things, you know, where when you ask me, you know, why I don't think I answered the question. Why do you teach children and not adults? And that's part of the reason, is that you get to exercise intelligence with the children, but you end up battling intellects, you know, as adults very often, because adults come in and they have wants, you know, and the wants sometimes are mutually exclusive, or at least they don't go together very well. Hey, I don't just want to hit the ball good. I want to look good. I want to look a certain way. And when guys are built a certain way, sometimes they can't do what they want to do and still hit the ball in a way that they desire. Yeah. So I don't like fooling around with that stuff anymore. I am sick of arguing with people about, and I'm also, questioning, am I doing the right thing for this person? I mean, that's one of the character traits of teachers, at least in my generation, is that if you were going to do, one of those profiles, the DISC profile, dominant, influencer, conscientious or cautious and steady, D-I-S-C, most teachers have a high C. They really don't want to do harm. Mm. High D people and let's say a D-I person, would be somebody that would just would want to be right, would want students to conform to a certain way of being. Now, that's not entirely true of, of those people, but that's been my experience. They want to be charismatic. They want to make a name for themselves as something, and they tend not to consider the student as much as they consider their system.
Let's say if you had a student, let's use me, for example. Say I came to you, and you accepted me as one of your few adult students. And I just want to get better. I want my scores to drop. What would you, and let's keep it to full swing. We'll stay away from short game and putting. What would you look for as like a reason to change something?
Well, if you had a miss that was really problematic, that would come up and would ruin your fun, would ruin your score. Like let's say a hook, and you couldn't, you could get your ball around, but then, when you get into certain situations, that hook would, rise up. We'd have to address that because that's how do we enable you to eliminate this part of your game which is not serving you? Mm-hmm. And so whether that would be whether that would ultimately be that you would change your basic swing, or whether it would simply be that you would develop a new shot.
Got it. Yeah.
That's where I would go. I would look at something. I think that people get freaked when, and I would, if you said, well, you can't be you anymore. You've got to be something else. But it's different if you were to say, I want to give you a new tool that you can, you can put in your repertoire, in your toolbox that you can use. And I think, that was an interesting thing about Pat Goss's talk yesterday was he was talking about the fact that he had been working with this tour player on his short game for like 3 years, and the tour player after it kept taking lessons from him, kept working on his, but didn't use the stuff on tour, didn't feel confident about it, and felt confident enough about it in fooling around matches, and stuff like that. But it took a while before this player, felt it was ready for prime time. Now, that it would take 2 and 3 years for an elite athlete, the top of their game, to develop this, just to give you an idea about what the process is, that confidence, learning something to the point of confidence to get through your own doubts, which may be not coming, maybe coming from something else, like I'm just not confident being in this competitive situation, down the stretch in contention, 18th hole, right. I'm at the bottom of the swale, the turf is tight, I've got to hit this flop shot up the hill. I'd rather putt it.
Yeah.
But so at any rate, that's I would start with, you know, with that. And if you were unstable in your you know, in your ground force, in your balance, we would look at that. You know, if the rhythm of your swing, if I felt like, gosh, you were operating at the upper edge of your potential is in terms of like hard swinging, you know, or speed, you know, I'd look at that, you know, because I think that sometimes what we get into is we're launching. You know, we want to make our game out of launching the ball as far as it goes. I want to see what kind of game I can make out of it. Every swing I'm going to make is just a rip fest. You know, and as we've seen Nick, the long drive guy in here, those guys, how many do they hit? How many times do they hit the grid?
One out of ten.
So when you try to make a game out of that kind of swinging, it's a game that you're going to lose because you're not going to be consistent up there. And it just depends now on what do you want. Do you want to keep playing that game and you know, see what you can do? And if you do, then fine. We'll try to do that. But, you know, we may need to call in some other professionals to exercise your body, to strengthen it so that you can throw loads, you know, and still keep your balance, but otherwise we need to find a level. We need to stimulate you to find a level where you can be a shot maker, and so that's very often where I go. In that case, you know, I would give you a challenge like, you know, let's hit your driver and see if you can hit it, you know, 225 yards instead of 300 yards to that green out there. And if you can do that, well, then I think you're very skillful, and you may end up teaching yourself, if you get down to that level, how to tweak this swing up. If you're using a TrackMan or something that's measuring dispersion patterns, you'll find out, you know, where your swing ceases to be reliable. And so I prefer, you know, I prefer to lead in that fashion more than just look at where you're, you know, unconventional.
Yeah, I mean, I heard on Cameron McCormick's podcast, he's Jordan Spieth's coach, that he's like the first 2 years he taught people, he just gave terrible lessons because all he did was kind of put them on video and make changes based on things he saw. So I just kind of wanted to hear your perspective on that. And you didn't, I mean, yeah, maybe you would use video as part of that, but not one of the first, second, third, or fourth, fifth places you'd think to go. So I think that's a cool perspective on it.
Well, you know, and that's from certainly from experience. You know, I mean, I had a revelation, you know, actually that came, I want to say it came 10 years ago, and that was that I was teaching to lines on a screen, and my student who'd been working on achieving the lines diligently for over a year got on the lines one day, and I was standing at the video, and his father was standing at my shoulder, and I looked at, you know, I considered his swing, and I realized that the substance of his swing was nowhere near what we were going for, and yet the form of his swing had matched the line. And with that, I mean, I became very disillusioned with my teacher and said, I don't think I can help people as much as I thought I could. So I changed my ways and changed my perspective about, you know, how to be helpful. And in some cases that meant I had to walk away from people who were accustomed to being taught in a certain way because I knew they would be disappointed by the way I would work with them.
Yeah. Well, all right, Pete. We're 5 minutes late for our operations meeting.
Let's go.
We better go. Alex will be mad at us.
All right. All right.
Thanks, you, everyone, Andy, for listening. Pete, thanks as always.
Clean contact.
I'd hit it again because that shot was a defining moment. And when a defining moment comes along, you define the moment, or the moment defines you.